WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi continues to roil Washington and much of the world. The president, for his part, stands firmly behind Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Donald Trump has claimed that we don't really know if bin Salman was implicated in the murder or not, dismissing the CIA's own conclusion that he was. But the thrust of Trump's reasoning is that the Saudi government is, after all, our ally, and it's just not our business who they kill. It's also not good business. Earlier this year, Dexter Filkins published a long article in the magazine about bin Salman, how he had consolidated his power, how he was going to take power very soon. And his relationship with the Trump administration was also discussed, and what Dexter found was extremely troubling. I talked with Dexter in April, and at that time, bin Salman was still being widely hailed as the great modernizer of Saudi Arabia, and he was making a huge impression on the world stage.
As somebody put it to me, an American diplomat, we're used to, you know, when we get on the phone with the king of Saudi Arabia, he's 85 years old and he's kind of half asleep and he mumbles a lot. And then the phone call's over. And this guy talks, you know, he's engaged.
He's 32 years old.
He's 32 years old. He's ambitious. He's impatient. He's charming. He's charismatic. He's tall. He's on the make.
So even as crown prince, MBS has been making some liberalizing moves. He's promised to overhaul the Saudi economy. He's lifted restrictions, including women driving. Is he offering real reform?
Yes, it's important to distinguish what kind of reforms. It definitely wants to open up the economy. There's a lot of economic reforms that he's initiated. He's trying to restrain the clergy. He's letting women drive. The one thing that's not on the table is political reform. This is all about saving the House of Saud
and maintaining power. So what is the economic predicament of Saudi Arabia?
It's pretty dire.
We think of them as just magnificently wealthy.
And they are. But they're burning cash at an extraordinary rate. And it's a vast welfare state where almost everything is subsidized from food to gasoline to education to healthcare, housing. But what's happening is that the whole economy was built on the idea that oil would be about $100 a barrel. And so they're just basically burning through their savings. And so as somebody put it to me in the story, at current trends, in 5 to 7 years, Saudi Arabia is broke. They're running out of money.
Unless they do what? Because I don't expect that in 5 to 7 years, the petro economy will disappear.
It won't disappear, but they can't sustain what they have. They don't export anything else. They import virtually everything else. So they've got to diversify. They got to do something else.
Now, MBS has also talked about inspiring a Saudi entertainment industry. I don't normally think of Riyadh as a kind of proto-Hollywood or New York or Paris in that way.
It's amazing. He's doing it. Movie theaters, concerts, with certain restraints, but he's doing it.
Well, let's get into the darker side of what's happening. Where are the main areas?
So in addition to all these things that he's done, at the very same time, he's arrested human rights leaders. He's detained journalists.
There's not going to be freedom of speech?
Absolutely not. I mean, that's just off the table. And in many ways, he's tougher than his predecessor. So he's clamping down on any kind of notion of political reform at the same time. And then, of course, we have the famous now wave of arrests when he dragged in dozens of very wealthy Saudis, even some of his relatives.
But he put them in that well-known prison, the Ritz-Carlton, which was
yes.
A very peculiar thing, no?
Very peculiar. I mean, it's a hotel for princes. It's just not generally for princes under arrest.
And maybe the main thing that happened at the Ritz-Carlton is that MBS forced any number of these people to give up either all of their assets or billions of dollars, tremendous amounts of assets, all in the name of anti-corruption. How is that done and toward what political end?
Well, you know, some of these were the richest people in the world were suddenly locked up in the Ritz-Carlton. And so as best we understand it, when they were sitting in their hotel rooms, from which the doors had been removed and anything that could be used to harm themselves, they were interrogated and their financial documents were kind of laid out in front of them, and they negotiated and arrived at a figure. And it usually, as I understand, it wasn't all of their money. It was some of it. So you're worth $2 billion, we get a billion. And so it was kind of agreed to, and then you signed that away. Everybody kind of shook hands, and then no one spoke about it when they came out. They didn't want anything really bad to happen to them.
Did anything bad happen to them?
Looks like it.
What happened?
There's at least one person who died in custody. It looks like under pretty grim circumstances. But at the end of the day, MBS got $100 billion from in the big shakedown.
The Saudi government got $100 billion from it. Wow. Your piece seems to imply that MBS has been making deals with the United States, and the Trumps are pleased to be making these deals for two reasons. One, for geopolitical reasons, and the other is for potentially for personal reasons. So this is more difficult to ferret out.
Yes.
Let's start with geopolitical. In the Obama administration attempted to create a kind of detente or better to say a balance of powers in the region by dealing with Iran, signing a nuclear deal, dealing with it in all the complexity that you have to deal with Iran. Now you have the Trump administration, which sees a pure friend in Saudi Arabia and a pure enemy in Iran.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, the Trump administration came in and said, this whole thing about sharing the neighborhood, which is what Obama said to the Saudis, share it. We're tearing that up. And we're going to go after Iran. And so, you know, the Iranians have essentially come to dominate, as they see it, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. They're everywhere. They're on the march. And we are going to roll them back. And I heard that phrase many times talking to people in the Trump administration, roll back the Iranians. And so in the past year, what have we seen? The Saudis and the Emiratis essentially tried to overthrow the government in Qatar. They think Qatar is too close to Iran. They tried to essentially overthrow the government in Lebanon. And then they launched this, you know, enormous and very bloody bombing campaign in Yemen, intervening in the civil war there because they see the Iranians as essentially behind it.
Which the United States assists in.
Yes, I mean—
On the Saudi side.
Yeah, I mean, the Obama White House kind of held their nose and said, okay, we'll keep sending you the bombs to drop. But they really didn't like it. And the Trump administration said, just, you know, go to it.
Dexter, you've explained the geopolitical reasons why the Trumps are going to be close to MBS and have been. There's also the personal aspect, the personal financial aspect to it. How would you break that down?
Well, this is complicated, but both the Trump and the Kushner families have financial interests in the Middle East.
So Qatar, which is home to a key American airbase, is currently the target of a blockade. Probably not by coincidence, but you tell me. Your reporting turned up evidence of a failed real estate deal between the Qataris and the Kushner family. What happened? And it seems to be a factor in the administration's attitude toward the blockade of Qatar.
All this is just remarkable. I'm shaking my head. The Kushner companies owns the big high rise
666 Fifth Avenue,
and with that has a mortgage of $1 billion, more than $1 billion, that's coming due soon. As I was told by a very credible source in the financial industry, the Kushner companies in April 2017 came to the Qataris in the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan
looking
for $1 billion. They asked for $1 billion.
As one does.
They had a big plan to kind of renovate the building and kind of make it all work. And the Qataris, they have a sovereign wealth fund with $300 billion in it. They have money to burn. They looked at the deal that Kushner had kind of laid out for them, Charles Kushner, Jared's father, and said, you know, forget it. Thanks very much, but no thanks. 6 weeks later, there's a blockade announced on Qatar.
John Bolton's going to be national security advisor very soon. How do his priorities and record square with MBS?
This is going to be a very unpredictable period. I think John Bolton is on. I think he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a few years ago, essentially calling for preemptive strikes against Iran. That's just exactly the sort of thing that MBS is thinking.
MBS compares the Iranian leadership to Hitler.
Yes. I had these conversations when I was in Riyadh. They said it's the Nazi ideology. And they do not merely want to dominate the Gulf. They want to destroy Saudi Arabia and conquer Saudi Arabia. And we are – it's no more Mr. Nice Guy. And so instead of what you had, I think, in the Obama administration – was they were essentially restraining the Saudis from getting into some kind of serious, maybe a shooting match with the Iranians in the Gulf. Now it's a completely different ballgame.
Dexter, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we spoke back in April. Both Dexter and Robin Wright have written a great deal about Jamal Khashoggi's killing and its repercussions, and you can find that at newyorker.com. Helen Rosner is a food correspondent for The New Yorker, not a restaurant critic. She writes about the culture of food, what people are eating, why they're eating it, why it all matters. She's always trying new stuff, and recently she experimented with fermentation. And she did so under the guidance of quite an authority on the subject, the celebrity chef Rene Redzepi. Helen, I heard you had an important visitor at your place recently. Tell me about it. What happened? What went on?
I did. I made a number of recipes from a new cookbook. The book is called The Noma Guide to Fermentation, and it's by Rene Redzepi, the chef at Noma, and David Zilber, who's the head of the Noma Fermentation Lab. So Rene came over with David Zilber. They showed up at 10 a.m. on a beautiful Sunday morning.
This is a nice place.
Thank you.
I'm not used to coming to New York and seeing people live in real homes.
Yeah.
Usually they live like in...
So Noma's a really big deal, and it's in Copenhagen, right?
Yeah, it's a really big deal. It's generally considered one of the best, if not the best, restaurant in the entire world. It's one of those high-end tasting menu kind of places where you pay several hundred dollars to sit down for several hours with a number of courses that are weird and wild and wonderful.
Weird and wild and wonderful how? What do I get when I go to Noma?
Well, at Noma...
For my hundreds of dollars.
Noma is particularly famous for... kind of being the locus of what has come to be known as the sense of place movement in high-end dining. So the chef, Rene Redzepi, has really turned to the landscape of Denmark and Scandinavia to find interesting ingredients and use interesting and unexpected techniques on them. He does a lot of foraging. He does a lot of getting to know the earth and the soil and the seas, and then taking what he finds there, often things that you might not expect to see on a menu, like ants, for example.
Ants.
Ants, which live
for
in
hundreds of dollars
Denmark.
For dinner.
Sure. A recent dessert at NoMa was a puree of blueberries and walnuts that was beautifully plated and garnished with a few perfectly placed ants.
So Rene Redzepi gets interested in experiments and experimental ways of cooking food or presenting it in some way or another. Fermentation is something that I kind of think of when I think of, I don't know, sauerkraut?
Yeah.
It's so, not a word that leaps to mind with delicious, though, necessarily. Obviously, I'm 100% wrong.
Well, I don't like to say you're 100% wrong, but sauerkraut is not the sexiest food. But at the same time, you know, it's undeniably wonderful, right? It's tart and it's effervescent and it's sour and it's complex. But what happens at NoMa a number of years ago, Rene and his team decided that fermentation was actually at the core of everything that they were doing. And they built what is sort of lovingly known as the NoMa Science Bunker or the NoMa Fermentation Lab.
So explain what fermentation is exactly. What is it, chemically speaking, what is it?
So chemically speaking, fermentation is the process of bacteria engaging with your food. Bacterias and yeasts, they sort of, I need it.
That sounds yummier all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah. I mean,
that sounds yummier all the time.
Good.
But it's fermentation is the chemical breakdown of a substance by bacteria, yeast, other microorganisms. I think I got that right.
Yes, you nailed that much better
because
than
I wrote it on the back of my hand.
I know, I
from chemistry class
in front of me.
Right, so you get it in yogurt, you get it in beer, you get it in cheese, even the much dread, although I'm sure many of our listeners love kombucha.
Sure. Yeah, that
God knows why
frizzy, sour, weird flavor that's in all of these foods
right.
that we love and that we really respond to. Though of course there are some people who really don't like that flavor, but they'll grow into it. David had actually mailed me a couple of days ahead of time from Copenhagen a mysterious package that I was instructed to put into the refrigerator right away. And this mysterious package contained what turned out to be barley koji.
If you've ever been to a cheap college dorm room and wandered into the bathroom and noticed the ceiling covered in black mold, you've met a relative of koji.
So koji is an interesting thing. It sort of looks like brown slime. And while Renee and I were the ones really getting our hands dirty making these three fermented things, David was standing by ready to answer in incredible detail every single question that I had.
Beyond koji's ability to break starches into sugars, it can also break proteins into amino acids, creating the flavor of umami. And that's where it comes into play in products like
soy
sauce.
He's kind of like a mad scientist of fermentation. He knows everything.
What's it like having these two guys in your kitchen? It must be a little on the intimidating side.
I was a little bit starstruck, I'm not going to lie. You know, they're really good at what they do, which was the great thing, and I felt very at ease with them. And the thing that really blew me away through all of it was how simple all three of these recipes were. All you do is mix these things with salt or with koji, and you wait.
And something unusual and fascinating and terrific comes out of it.
Exactly. You know, fermentation is in all sorts of foods that we already eat. But if you decide to really set out to do it yourself at home with seriousness, the way this book wants you to, it involves all sorts of specialized ingredients. So you become a person who winds up buying mold on the internet or going in search of a specialty bacteria when you travel overseas. And actually, Rene Redzepi told us an incredible story about a time he was trying to travel home from Mexico with a really exciting fermentation ingredient.
They unpacked my bags. And within 5 minutes, there's like 15 machine guns around me, really. And you know what? They open one of the bags and they put their finger in, like you see in the movie, and they were like this.
They tested it. They think you were smuggling
I think
drugs?
They thought it was drugs. And I told them, it's mold. And then when it was sweet, you know, they all laughed.
How do you get it? Like, do you scrape it off a wall? Or like?
No, you get it as a powder.
Okay.
Yeah, you can have these powdered up, but I guess you could scrape it off a wall.
So you can't get this stuff even at Whole Foods?
Most Japanese supermarkets will have koji available, and if you don't have a Japanese supermarket near you, you can order it online. I had the good fortune of having NoMa's own homegrown barley koji. But making the hazelnut miso couldn't have been more simple.
All right, so I make hazelnut miso how?
Here's how you do it. You take hazelnut flour, you combine it with a certain amount of the barley koji, you add a little bit of salt, you pack it into a jar, and you wait.
And then I have it.
You have hazelnut miso.
So after they left, you were left in charge of checking in with all this fermentation that was going on in your refrigerator. The blueberries, the hazelnut miso, and even some mushrooms.
Yeah. And I recorded an audio diary of what I found.
We have different lives.
All right. It's day 3, because I forgot to do this yesterday. And I'm going to check on our 3 jars. So first up, we have the blueberries, and wow, there is some serious blueberry juice starting to form at the bottom of this jar.
Oh, here we are on day 4, I guess.
Okay, I kind of want to give this a shake or something, but I don't want to mess anything up. It's clear that they're starting. Hey, what's wrong, sweetheart? Can I talk to my phone? Give me 1 second.
Well, here we are on the 9th day. Well, the blueberries and the mushrooms have now been going for a little bit over a week, which means it's time to test them. So I'm gonna open the jar and give them a taste, and I'll report back.
Now, Helen Rosner, we come to the crucial moment. Apparently, you've bought stuff to eat.
I did. I brought snacks.
Can I say, guests should always bring snacks. It's just the right thing to do. What do you got?
So the first thing is I brought you some yogurt and honey so we can make a little mini parfait with the blueberries.
All right. I think I've done right there. Okay. And you want and put regular old honey in
there. Yeah, just plain old honey
in it. The upside down little bear guy.
Yeah.
Okay. You're not joining me? Come on, Helen.
I'll have a little.
All right.
Can you pass me a spoon?
Damn right I will. Okay. Let's try this out. Mm. Like that. That is weirdo, but great.
Yeah. That's my favorite of the 3.
That's fantastic.
I'm a huge fan of that. And the thing that really blows my mind with this
Can
whole
I have
process.
More?
Yes, please. Here, there's spoons on the table.
It's like it's created a whole new berry.
Yeah.
I mean, they're blueberry adjacent now.
Right.
Really good. Okay. And what would you do with this? Like pancakes or?
Yeah, you can do all sorts of things. You know, in the book, they recommend running them through a blender or a food processor and kind of pureeing them and, you know, because it's very.
Yeah, I wouldn't have the patience for that. Yeah. You got the blueberries, I'm eating them.
Well, once they're blended, though, they suggest really fascinating things like using it in a homemade barbecue sauce or brushing an ear of corn with it and then grilling the corn.
Fermented blueberry ground up in a food processor and smeared over a ear of corn.
Sure.
Man, I wouldn't have thought of that.
First, this is the mushrooms.
Should I open it?
If you want to, yeah. Take a whiff to it.
Take a whiff, she says.
It smells like something very specific to me, and I'm curious if it smells like the same thing to you.
Oh, it smells kind of boozy.
Yeah. I think it
boozy
smells like
mushrooms.
I think it
what
smells
could
like
be
apple
bad?
Cider. There's something very cidery to me.
You got it.
Well, let's try what I made
with
the
mushrooms.
Okay,
now we have green beans.
This is a prepared dish. This is, you know, food TV style I came in with
I
the
really
final
should
thing.
Not have eaten lunch before this, but.
Well, so I'm giving you these in sort of. Okay, reverse order of how much I like them.
Fantastic advertising. These are green beans that have what on them?
The dressing is made out of a combination of the fermentation liquid from the mushrooms, so this mushroomy, salty brine, and then an oil that I made by infusing non-fermented mushrooms in a neutral oil and a little bit of diced shallot.
Okay, this is delicious, I think largely because you cook these beans, they're crispy and they're fantastic. Oh, this is cool. This is really good.
Yeah.
And we're going to crunchy bean sound, too. God. You know, right, so. Now you have a package, a container of what looks like cookies.
When I started mixing the koji in with the hazelnut meal, I noticed that it felt a lot like cookie dough. And I asked Renee if you could just make cookies out of the hazelnut miso itself. And to my incredible delight, he thought it was kind of a cool idea and suggested that he and David should play around with it when they get back to the Noma kitchen.
Can you make a miso cookie?
You know what? Have we ever done that?
Miso cookies?
Yeah?
No.
Have we ever just put an egg in this and tried to bake it?
No.
Oh.
We can't.
Live Noma innovation happening in my home right now.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. Magic just happened.
This is what we wanted.
The book is making
a- You like it.
Mmm.
You really like it.
They're really good. So my wife and I have the same affliction. We're one of those people who are always asking the waiter or for salt. This is the saltiest cookie I've ever had. Therefore, one of the best.
I am delighted and surprised that you like this. I think
I've never tasted anything like this. This was fantastic. Now, is this going to become part of your
cooking regimen, the fermentation?
Yeah, you know, it already was, it turned out. I'm a big fan of making things like preserved lemons, and I have definitely once or twice experimented with making my own kombucha.
Be truthful with me. It's your last hour on Earth, and you've got the best kombucha possible over on your left and the best beer possible over on your right. What are you reaching for?
Well, beer is also fermented.
Yeah, I know. so much better.
It depends on the beer, and it depends on the kombucha. I'm not good at answering these questions.
You know what this leaves us with? Our next segment... Down the road. How about that?
We'll do a kombucha versus beer taste test.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ellen Rosner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to try making those fermented hazelnut flour cookies, well, we've got the recipe at newyorkerradio.org, and best of luck. That's our show for today, and I want to thank you for joining us. And I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.